This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
I'm just going to come right out and say it right from the get-go. This is the worst episode. This will be the worst episode of this show we've ever made because this is going to be like... Remember when you were a kid and you turn on TV and there'd be like, I think they still do this though. There's like a channel where everyone on the channel is selling something.
QVC.
Ronco.
This is like watching that. This is like watching an infomercial. I'm just going to come flat out and say it. But there's some special parts to it. Right now, here's the deal. If even a small percentage, of the people that will listen to this show, if a small percentage, almost like a single digit percentage, is that right? Yeah. Of the people that will listen to this show would go on to Amazon right now and get $35 and go buy the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook, whose subtitle is Recipes and Techniques for Every Hunter and Angler, which is available for its launches. It's like coming out November 20. If a small fraction of people listen to this would go do it, it would do me such a huge favor and I would like be really happy. It'd be like my life goal would have been achieved and I would never work again.
What they should do is buy two.
Because it's Christmas time.
Yeah.
So the how many pages are in that book? We actually brought an actual salesman who's never... Matt, how many units, Matt Cook, how many units of things have you sold in your life?
Not as many as I could sell this book.
Well, you're feeling that confident.
I'm feeling that confident.
He's a professional salesman, well-trained, has never touched the book, but we brought him in just to work up a sales pitch to sell it.
Absolutely.
He's working on it right now, but just quick, how many pages? And I'm going to talk about some other stuff.
350 pages of goodness.
350 pages covering... processing of, so like how to cut up, how to cook, over 100 original recipes, and processing in recipe and cooking and fixing and substitution information for everything. It's broken down like this. And then I'm going to talk about some other stuff for a while. I'm just going to keep returning to this damn book to try to talk people into just doing me a humongous favor and going and buying it now. It's broken up into big game. So like, you know, mostly like antlered and horned Bengay, but also pigs and bears. And then small game, which is like furred small game. So hares, rabbits, squirrels. And then upland birds, waterfowl, freshwater fish, saltwater fish, shellfish and crustaceans, and reptiles and amphibians. All about, have you ever seen a more beautiful pictorial of how to butcher a snapping turtle?
No, I've never seen a reptiles and amphibians chapter. No, it's beautiful.
That's because most cookbooks suck. you haven't heard this. I was going to make everyone here pretend that I didn't tell them. So you guys are good at lying, right?
Real good.
Okay, so sure. Lie for a minute. But Matt wasn't here, so let me ask you this. A guy wrote in that, this is interesting, speaking of wild game, his freezer went kaput on him, and it shouldn't have gone kaput on him. So he calls his insurance agent, and he wants to make a claim on having lost all of his wild game. So he calls his insurance agent, and the guy says, I've been in this business for a decade, and no one's ever asked me about how to handle a claim on having lost wild game, like what the value of it is. So this guy goes to the state office and comes back with this. The Farm Bureau of the state of Mississippi had come up with this formula years ago, lack of formula, that since there's no comparable market value for wild game, the only monetary replacement you can get when you make a claim on losing your wild game is the cost of processing. If you processed your own wild game, you're out of luck. So when you lose a freezer, you lose a whole elk because your freezer goes to shit. Your insurance might compensate you, but limited to what you paid to have it processed is the only value they'll assign to it. And this guy
goes, you just drop like an invoice that said, I paid my wife $1,000 to process.
Yeah. I don't know how deep they dig, but it's really interesting, man. And he's like, the dude that wrote in is talking about how, you know, so, you know, we've talked about this 1,000 times, but the, you know, wild game resources in this country were depleted horribly. Deer, turkeys, waterfowl, passenger pigeon driven to extinction, buffalo nearly driven to extinction by market hunters. So people that shot game and sold it into commercial markets and made a living doing it. And one of the many things we had to do to save American wildlife was end the selling of wild game. We've talked about this a bunch too. Like the other night I was in a situation where I was almost forced to go eat pen-raised elk. So if you see elk on a restaurant menu, it's not real elk. It's the elk raised up on a, you know, it's the elk raised up on a farm or ranch, right? It's not, you can't sell wild game. So he's saying that this is one downside to that system is you can't get properly compensated.
What if you shot the elk on a $10,000, you know, paid guided trip? Could you turn that in to the insurance company? I certainly would try.
Well, all I can tell you, and this is just anecdotal, because this is just one mug from Mississippi, but that's what he had happen to him, and that's what he found when he researched it. Now, maybe if you had some hard-hitting lawyers or something, but I would tend to doubt it, man. I would tend to doubt it, because there you're paying for the experience.
But you would, you're right, Giannis, you'd have an invoice. You'd have, you know, a credit card statement that was the dollars that generated that. But I certainly think people should try. I think maybe one agent to another may be able to slip one through.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be worth a try. Here's another thing. We were talking about swamp rabbits. The cottontail rabbits, when a cottontail rabbit shits in the woods, he doesn't seem to pay a whole lot of attention where he goes. He just goes.
Matt, wherever. Are you cool on swamp rabbits? Does that
You know what a swamp rabbit is?
I absolutely do not know what a swamp rabbit is.
Silvalagus aquaticus?
Okay, the Latin name. Yep, now I'm familiar.
Do you know?
I got it now. If you go by Latin, I'm good.
Do you know that rabbits aren't rodents, Matt?
I did know that rabbits were not rodents.
They're lagomorphs.
They're a lagomorph. Absolutely.
So the swamp rabbit is just a souped up cottontail.
Okay.
5-6 pound cottontail who will jump in the Mississippi River and swim across in order to evade a hunting beagle.
It is a indigenous to the South swamp rabbits. We don't have them.
But you know, not, they can go into the deep South, but they're also found in the border country. We've been debating a lot about what is the South,
okay,
you know, and, but they're in Kentucky.
Okay.
Okay. Which is the South, but some people feel like it's nudging, it's edging toward the North. One time Lincoln, I think, sat in Ohio and yelled across the river at Kentucky, mad at them about Southern issues. But so, normal cottontail rabbit, Eastern cottontail, mountain cottontail, he just shits wherever he wants, right? They don't have any rhyme or reason to it. But a swamp rabbit has fidelity to his latrine. And Giannis has seen this. Back me up.
I have.
A guy was pointing out, I was talking about this, puzzling over it. And saying like when it, in their environs where they live, it's very flat because they live on the floodplain. And I thought maybe he gets a log he likes to go on and he defecates on the log and it just makes it higher and higher up. Because a llama, who also has fidelity to his latrine, will defecate and build up such a mound of pellets that he uses as a lookout, like a crow's nest.
Wow.
A fella wrote in, and he was saying that he doesn't really know about this idea that rabbits defecate on a log with the intent of building up a little mound that they can sit on. He says that may be true, but he also points out that it's necessary for cottontails to eat their own poop. It's called caprophagy. And he wonders about if it's not in the in these environs that are prone to flooding, that if it's not just a good way for him to store his
doo-doo. Why are they eating their
own? I don't say that very often.
Why are they eating their own shit?
You know, it has something to do with their digestive tract. Maybe Yanni can look that up. A lot of times you'll ask him to look stuff up, and then by the end of the show, he'll find it.
So I have a sales idea.
Because he damn sure doesn't have anything to add to the...
You could domesticate swamp rabbits so that, you know, like a cat, it would shit in the same place in your house versus a cottontail, which would shit all over the house.
Yeah.
There's a business opportunity there.
I like the way you're thinking. Now, guy wrote in, this is interesting. Guy writes in, we were talking recently about the sort of existential crisis that hunters in New Zealand and Australia are facing right now, where hunters in New Zealand and Australia are predominantly hunting. You know, there's like kangaroo hunting there for commercial markets, but like your recreational hunters in Australia and New Zealand are hunting non-natives. And they will often justify their pursuits by explaining how they're helping to control. And if you go on social media and you watch, you'll see Australian hunters, you know, talking about this. Like, man, you know, to save the natives, we got to do all this hunting. But then what happened, the reason we were talking about this recently is because in New Zealand, the government, who does a lot of culling, they do a lot of control work on some of these more abundant non-native ungulates. They do a lot of control work on them, and they're talking about upping the control work and getting rid of them. And it's making the hunters there real uneasy. And I was pointing out how it's hard because you're sort of justifying your activity by saying we're helping to control non-natives, but then when the government decides just to do a total eradication, the hunters get nervous because they want some. And so you're left with where your rhetorical strategy, right, the thing you use to justify your activities becomes null and void. And a guy actually wrote in from Australia, and he was saying that he says it does put us in a funny position. Because he says, quote, we are left exposed to the harsh reality of not just saying that we want them here so we can hunt them. What do you think about that, Yanni?
I'm glad that he wrote in and accepted that.
Just admitted it.
Yeah.
It's tricky, man. I wouldn't like...
But we've been saying, and I think all along, it's been a lousy argument why you should hunt and just lousy justification for hunting, really.
Yeah, you can't act like, yeah, if I think a lot of people do it in a lot of different ways. People struggle with, you know, it's complicated, right? If someone said, hey, man, why do you like to go to baseball games? You're not going to have like, oh, a reason. It's a whole bunch of reasons, going back to how you were brought up and what it makes you think of and time with family. You like hot buttered popcorn. I mean, right, all manner of things. This is a huge package of things. But I think hunters a lot of times get in this thing where they try to narrow it down. Or like, oh, if we didn't hunt, the deer would overtake us and kill us all.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. And when you get into this, like where it's justified by, where you're just saying like, oh, no, I just do it for population control. And then someone says, oh, you know, don't worry about it, bro. We'll take care of it. The government will do it. Then you're like, then you got to be like, man, I wish I would have said something different. Another guy wrote in about, he says a good way to have chew, good way to dip. He likes to mix. He mixes Hubba Bubba.
The bubble gum?
Yeah, with Red Man.
I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
Have we consulted with Dirt on that? Is that
no, but that's,
what that's a baseball player thing.
That's who he's writing in about. And he says the question is, what do you get first, cancer or diabetes?
That's a strange mix.
Yeah. Another guy wrote in. He's like, man, you guys are always arguing about Tony C's and Old Bay. Steve being a Tony C's man and Yanni being an Old Bay man. And he's like, what about Mrs. Dash? Big Mrs. Dash fan.
It has its place, but it's not like the other two.
He thinks it's real good to take like fish fillets and put some Mrs. Dash on it and wrap the fish up in aluminum foil and cook it. He likes to take pickerel. Pickerel, you wrap them in tinfoil, put some butter and some Mrs. Dash on there. He says you're floored how good it is. He doesn't put anything else on his fish.
Isn't Mrs. Dash like a, it's across the country, right? And isn't Old Bay and Tony C's kind of just Maryland and like.
No, dude, Tony C's is everywhere, man.
Yeah, really?
I got on to Tony C's. I got on to Tony C's in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
What?
You can't get farther away from the Bayou country and still be in the country.
I've been duped.
Well,
man.
Alaska.
I've been lied to for a while then.
We used to call Tony C's Uncle Tom's for some reason. I have no idea why.
Huh.
You know Uncle Tom's cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Harry
Beecher Stowe,
right? Probably
couldn't pronounce Chattrees.
Yeah, it was like some kind of shortcut, but I still don't understand how you'd come up with Uncle Tom's. Someone must have been reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. We've been having a lot of talk about how well dogs can smell. And a guy wrote in, and he's a police officer, and he's a canine handler. He was trained for 2 years to work with canines. He worked with a half German Shepherd, half Belgian Malinois. Anybody know this? Malinois?
Nope.
Anyway, some kind of souped up mutt. And dog's name was Kane. And he was a dual purpose dog, meaning he was a narcotic detective dog and suspect apprehension.
Oh, yeah. That's a mean looking dude right there. That's like the guy that in movies, when a police dog chomps on the bad guy's arm, that's the Malinois.
Yeah. Well, you know what he's saying about this dog?
Tell me.
He's talking about, only reason he wrote in is because we were struggling to explain like how well a squirrel dog can smell. Like, how can a squirrel dog do such a good job of smelling squirrels? And he just brings up a way that it was explained to him. One, he says it was explained to me in training that dogs can smell up to 50,000 times better than we do, which is like hard to, right? It's still hard. But he's like, there's a good anecdote. There's a thing called the cake theory. So let's say your mom bakes a cake and you walk in the house. You walk in the house and you take in the smell and you're like, oh, someone made a cake.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the smell you get. He says a good way to think about it would be that a dog walks in the house and he goes, oh, eggs, flour, milk, salt, sugar. And that's how he feels that they're a way to distinguish their abilities from our own. Another guy wrote in, and here's a guy. He's kind of established his credentials. You remember, Yanni, can you recap the Andrew McLean story, the famous skier?
Mm-hmm. I believe I can. He was caught.
Explain, like, who he is and what he does and whatnot.
It was Andrew McLean, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to mix him up with some other famous skier, but he's like a Utah backcountry skier known for pioneering, I think, some lines in the Wasatch and writing a ski guidebook for skiing the Wasatch.
And, is that how you say that?
Mm-hmm.
I always said it a little dinky bit wrong.
Well, I'm sure.
Wasatch.
Yeah, that's what I would have said.
Yeah.
Wasatch. I'm in and out of that place all the time. Go ahead.
Anyways, he was caught on trail camera stealing a trail camera and a tree stand or two, maybe even. The hunter for some reason had like a double camera set and they only saw one camera and took it and the tree stand and the other camera caught them in the act of doing it.
Stealing. Well, this guy writes in and he's kind of like setting up his credentials. He opens up by saying, I'm just headed out to film a dinosaur digging project for Nat Geo. So he's like laying, he's like,
okay,
you know what I mean? He doesn't say like why that matters, but he throws it out there because he's wanting to paint a picture. He's like
build up his street cred.
He's building up some cred. So you're supposed to be like, man, well, you guys are camera guys. When you hear that he's going to film a dino digging thing, are you thinking like this guy's top shelf?
Depends on what branch in that geo it is, man. there's a couple different ones.
So you hear that and you don't automatically think that you're, because I'm going to get into a negative about this
person. It's on Nat Geo Kids.
That's just to say, yeah, Nat Geo Kids. I'm like, eh.
because we're going to get into a negative about this guy. He sets up his credentials by saying he's in Niger, which is in Africa, and he's heading out to film a dino digging project for Nat Geo. And he says, "I get why McLean did it." And he talks about he just started bow hunting this season, and he talks about how hunters litter a lot. And a lot of times you'll find where hunters leave little stashes out in the woods and a lot of garbage out in the woods and a tattered sleeping bag and old tarp and unusable MREs and doesn't like it. Hunters are real dirtbag woods trashers. And he goes on to say that he goes on to propose the idea that McLean was simply cleaning up the woods by stealing a tree stand and a trail camera, which is an indefensible position to take. There's a big difference between garbage left out in the woods and someone's legally placed tree stand and trail camera. Anyone want to add to that?
Hear, hear.
That's the lovely voice of Mark Kenyon.
Yeah, you could take that a bunch. You could say, like, your car is like a hunk of metal just sitting out there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to steal that to clean this place up.
Cleaning up some new truck I found out in the woods.
I think the more interesting thing is the tactic that the hunter who had his stuff stolen, I think the tactic he used was something that more people should use in the whitetail world.
Double camera.
And I do know some people have talked about it. I've got a friend who was trying this. But it's a great way to, if we get the word out that enough people are doing that, I think a lot of trail camera thieves will think twice.
Mm. To do the double camera.
Yeah, because I might be getting pictured right now.
We had a dude showing us a bunch of trail cameras on his, we were mule deer hunting in Colorado and ran into a fella. Remember this, Yanni? And he was showing us a bunch of trail cam pictures of various elk and mule deer and whatnot. And they all were taken at a downward angle. Mm-hmm. You remember right. this? And I was like, what the
hell's
going on?
The guy from New Mexico.
Yeah. I was like, what's going on with this? He said, trail camera theft is so bad in New Mexico that he now places his trail cameras up high up in trees, angled down.
So I do that on public land.
People don't notice them.
Yeah.
Doesn't the cameras that send the pictures to the internet, you know, deter some of the stealing? I mean, you'd get a picture when someone goes to steal your camera. Has that curbed any of the theft?
The direct transmit.
Yeah.
I think that the percentage of trail cameras out there that have that feature is still so small.
Okay.
But yes, I think that it's getting to the point that more and more people worry about that. I actually have gone to the point where I place no trespassing signs that I will specifically say property. I'll write in marker property patrolled with cellular cameras, that kind of thing, where there's some serious issues of trespassing. So they say, oh yeah, so that I can't steal the camera. Picture's gonna be sent right away. That's a heck of a deterrent.
And it's true or not true?
It's true.
Okay. You know, this is take this with. I'm gonna say something and keep in mind that I'll just come out and say it. If I could, if I was the command master of the universe, I would get rid of trail cameras. But I would also get rid of the internet. And I use the internet. And in fact, this is like an internet-based digital radio program. So it's like I'm comfortable using it. But if I was commander of the universe and I could make it go away, I would make it go away. And I would make trail cameras go away. Even though I will use trail cameras, I wish they hadn't been invented.
I understand that position.
And I understand both sides. But one, I love trail cam pictures. I post them all the time on social media because it's like cool. I like how they've rewritten some of our understanding of wildlife distribution. And I love it. And it, like, you learn from it. But there's just something about it is like, I only don't like them when I run into one. I like my friends a lot. I just don't like other people's. And I think that a lot of people are getting a little bit wigged out with the fact that there's like surveillance in the hills now.
I get that. I do think it also, there's something to be said about, and I've kind of battled with this a little bit myself, the fact that it takes a little bit of the mystery away. there's something to be said about going out into the woods and not knowing what might show up later tonight. Now it's, well, it's going to be this buck, or that buck. And there's never a surprise.
Dude, the buck I saw this morning, I was trying to figure out what one it was from the trail cam pictures you were showing me.
so
yeah, you're like, you're sitting out there. You feel like you're like waiting for a friend when you're out in the woods now, man.
I know he comes here.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, there's the one guy and the other guy. Yeah, I kind of like, I don't like it, but that's not what I don't like about it. I don't like being out and all of a sudden realizing there's like some guy's trail camera sitting there.
Yeah.
Why not confine him to private?
You know what's cool? It was cool, but it went away. Like Montana for a couple of years had it be that when big game season opened, you had to pull them.
That just changed this past year.
Then they made it go back the other way again.
Mm-hmm.
Something, it's just going to get too ridiculous because as the technology gets better and like people are just able to like live stream. It just is, I don't know, man. It's just too much.
There needs to be some kind of limits. Some kind of regulation.
Yeah, we limit all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, we need to have that. That's what I'm saying. I think one
thing. You can't use a red dot sight on your bow. There's like all kinds of stuff we limit.
The regulation I would like to see put on trail cameras has to do with cell cameras. Because that's where I see this line being crossed with some line of ethics. And everyone's going to have their own opinion on this. But I find where it gets real weird for me is when you get a picture now that's happening right now and you can make a hunting decision right now based off of real-time data. That seems to go over the line for me personally. I wish there was like a fair chase mode that you could turn on your trail camera, or maybe there'd be a law someday that requires this, that requires a 24-hour delay before anything gets sent. So there's no real-time. You're not going to see what's happening right now. You can get the benefits of a cell camera, that being it gets transmitted to your computer or phone so that if you live 1,500 miles away or whatever, you can still get your pictures. Or if you don't want to have to go in there every 2 weeks and put your scent all over the place. But this at least keeps you from abusing that technology. At least I think it's abuse if you see a picture on your phone right now and go stalking in there and shoot that buck. That's like, for me, that's...
That's why you need to, when you're going to do stuff like this, usually the fish and game agencies try to get out ahead of it before it becomes standard accepted practice. Mm-hmm. Like how people were so aggressive around regulating the use of drones before drones became super widespread and had so much common use. Because then it's hard because there's like a resistance built up. And I just haven't seen anywhere doing like that kind of leadership on looking like, where is this going? Where you can be out in the woods, you know, you go out and plant 20 cameras that are all giving you a live feed of what's going on. And you got them in all your elk meadows, or you got them in all your, you got a camera on all of your duck ponds that you like to go jump shoot. And you got a live stream on your phone. I mean, we're like, you could do this right now.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, let's go hit that pond, jump that pond. They're on the whatever end of the pond, so let's make sure we approach from that end.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of states, and I think more should get on board, have banned two-way communications to, like, coordinate the taking of game. It's just someone's going to have to get out ahead of it.
I feel like it's definitely, on my property, is influenced, you know, how we look at it when game move, it's demystified. Or maybe it shouldn't have, you know, demystified if, you know, there's animal activity in the middle of the day. You know, we've never been in a position where, you know, let's go hunt. That buck is on that spot at this particular time. But overall movement, you know, or you look and see, you know, they moved overnight because it was a full moon. And you probably will have a slow morning. It hasn't equated to success in particular. It has definitely reduced trespassing because you only have to catch someone, you know, 10 minutes after they've been there. Not only I think you're a freak for monitoring, but if you go there and show them a picture of them on your property within a few minutes, the word gets out, prevents a lot of trespassing.
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot of positives. But it's something that concerns me, and I think it's going to become more of an issue as the technology gets better. Mark Kenyon, Wired to Hunt. So you think you're wired to hunt. Let me ask you this.
This is how the email started? Someone said that?
No, I'm saying that. This is a great question. Guy writes in, my dad and I have been hunting on a large property next door to their house, almost 1,000 acres, for all of our lives. 3 years ago, the founder of a chip company, I don't want to name the chip company, the founder of a chip company bought the land, and he puts a fence up around it for the purpose of keeping his cattle from roaming off the property. But it's a nice big decorative fence. He puts an 8-foot wood fence around the perimeter of the whole property.
8-foot tall wood fence.
He says to keep his cattle in.
Wow.
The guy's still allowed to hunt it. But he's always been uneasy with the idea of hunting high fence. So here is, he's always hunted a property. All of a sudden it becomes fenced. They go in there last year on opening weekend. They both get a deer. And then they agreed not to hunt anymore. They just can't decide. He says he still goes in there to trap. He goes in there to small game hunt, but he feels weird hunting ducks, hunting deer on it, knowing that the deer are stuck in there and can't get out.
Wow.
That is a tough one, man.
What a bizarre scenario.
That is a tough scenario.
Can anyone put a 8-foot decorative fence around their property where you're basically, you have captive wildlife?
Right, you're privatizing.
Isn't that
wildlife? In Texas, he doesn't say what state he's in, but I wouldn't be surprised.
But any property, if you know there's wildlife, can you build a decorative fence around your property knowing that it's going to capture wildlife on the inside?
Yeah, well, when people do high fence things on high fence stuff in Texas, yeah, you don't need to like kick all the deer off and then build the fence.
But it's not, is that regulated by state wildlife?
I don't know what the permitting system is. And I don't know, he doesn't say where he is. I'm more interested in not to see if the guy's being, I'm not really interested if the dude, I mean, it's interesting. Yep. I'd love to know if the dude is like breaking a law or not, just,
yep.
But I'm more interested in like the idea of it.
Yep.
So here is, he hunts and all of a sudden it's fenced. Does he go get a new spot? That's a really, really tough question, man. I feel like if that happened to me, I don't know, man. It'd be real hard to go and like walk away from your spot.
I understand. I think I would feel dirty. I would feel, at least for me, I would start to have weird questions about it because of that point he brought up. Like all of a sudden now you're hunting a high fence property and all the things that means possibly.
Thing is, 1,000 acres is big.
It's big. But then we talk about the reduction of mystery. You're never going to get a surprise deer on there again. You're never going to have the risk of someone else getting that deer or that deer disappearing. Or there, yeah, it's still a challenge, of course. There's still going to be a lot of work probably has to go into it, but it's different.
Different. It would be diminished.
It would be diminished. And I would probably do the same thing he did.
Yanni? Yanni's thinking so hard.
I just don't. It's never going to have come up again. He's going to be the only guy ever in the history of our country to have to wrestle with this.
1,000-acre decorative fence.
So
I actually want to see the fence.
I feel sorry for the guy. He's got to wrestle with it, but I don't know if like us talking about it is going to help anybody else.
So you just don't see it being an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just get to go in there and see how it feels. And, like, I would just say, look, keep hunting it until you're like, okay, that was so easy and due because of the decorative fence, and I'm quitting, you know?
I got to add here that I am the one that I use the word decorative. He doesn't use the word decorative, but an 8-foot wood, no.
First thing is
an 8-foot wooden fence is not a practical fence. There's cheaper ways of doing that.
There's an incredible amount of money spent on a 1,000-acre fence.
Yeah, 8-foot insane.
High. That's a typical insane. High fence.
Yeah.
What's a typical high fence? They're high.
Just barbed wire.
It's just like woven wire.
Yeah, I thought you meant height. Ridge pounder? You got nothing to say about that, probably, dude.
No,
it's
kind
of out of your area.
No, I got an opinion. He's got to hang it up, dude. He's got to just give that spot up. There's no question.
Really?
In my mind, yeah.
It's not easy for me, man.
No, there's a fence there, dude.
I don't know. I feel like I'd probably still poke around in there now and then.
You can poke around all you want.
I'd just be like, I don't know. Maybe he didn't fence the whole thing.
But would you be like him and hanging up just big game? Or would you say, yep, the rabbits are high fenced now. The squirrels are high fenced. Can't hunt.
There's no such thing as a high fence squirrel.
Yeah, because the squirrels can jump.
That's true.
Rabbits, I don't really. That's up to him. But yeah, man, he's got to quit.
Did you know a guy wrote into you?
A guy wrote into me?
Yeah.
About what?
The gray rabbit.
What does he got to say?
He says you should have done candlelight dinner.
Hide the grayness.
Yeah.
That is very, very smart.
Okay, one more real zinger. Real zinger.
Don't forget, you're supposed to be pushing the cookbook.
Well, I'm coming around to that. I'm giving Matt time to work up a sales pitch. Then I want to talk about the cookbook.
I have a question real quick about the dog and the smell.
I don't know the answer, but go ahead.
Okay, let me ask this question. I was pheasant hunting last year, and it was September, and it was hot. And our guide said that one of the issues the dog was having was your analogy that he used chili, that the dog can smell all of the spices, the beef and everything, and that it was if it's cold out, it's not as hard on the dog. The dog can find pheasants easier, but when it's hot, they can smell every ingredient. You know, they smell the plants. You know, they can smell other animals, rabbits. Have any of you heard that heat?
I feel like I've heard that. My buddy Ronnie Baim would absolutely have a lot to say about that, so we'll have to return to that.
Okay.
I had heard dryness versus moisture. So if like a moist situation, they'll be able to smell more. And I heard this in the context of tracking deer. So tracking a wounded deer or a hit deer, actually tracking on a rainy day is better than a bone dry day.
Similar there. He was saying, you know, when it was cold and he didn't say if there was snow or not, that the dog could identify a pheasant scent much easier if it's cold because it's a singular scent versus overwhelmed by all of the scents when it's warm.
I'm tracking what you're saying. And I can't remember. I know that I heard when I was running dry ground lions with someone one time, with a feller by the name of Floyd, we were tracking mountain lions with dogs, and I remember he had a lot of opinions about the climatic conditions and its effect on a dog's nose and its ability to cold trail and hot trail. I just can't remember what, you know, like what was good and what was bad. But I remember that he had a lot of thoughts about it. Did you see the Matt's running that axe we liked a whole lot, Yanni?
No, I see it now.
Oh, yeah. You know? That's the Alaska axe, man.
Yeah, man. Well, it's the old, I forget what it was called.
S-Wing.
S-Wing. But what's the name, the model?
That's like one of the nicest mass-produced axes I've ever laid a hand on, Matt. I'm not trying to butter you up because you're going to give a sales pitch of this book. Okay, here's one more real zinger. Real zinger for everybody. This is more of a zinger than the zinger from a minute ago. He goes on to say how he hates hunting shows. That's cool. Then he goes on to say lots of reasons. He goes on to say how he's heard me mention that if you took away the food or you took away the fun, I would lose interest in hunting. Like it's a package of things that all need to be there for me to love it like I do. And he goes on to say that he needs my opinion on something. He works with a fella who he generally likes. We get along just fine. And he goes on to say this. The dude is, this is why I almost wonder if this like is true. I feel like it must be true. The guy is a vegetarian. Okay? But not one of those annoying ones that throws it in your face. But here's where it gets weird. He's a vegetarian, but he hunts. He likes to hunt deer and turkeys, but doesn't believe in eating them.
What?
He just donates it all to a food bank. And the guy's saying, I cannot wrap my head around this. And he says, no one buys a pair of pants from JCPenney just to take them down to the Salvation Army and drop them off.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, there probably are a few charitable folks that do that.
That buy clothes and then donate them.
It's a good question, man. Like, you won't eat it, but you like to shoot it. I've always, like, it's another one of those things. It's just one of those things I see both sides of. I can't really work up a good opinion about it.
The fact that he's a vegetarian has nothing to do with it, because I feel like I know dudes that are full-on carnivores that do the same thing.
Yeah, but it makes it kind of even more zingy, like, that he's a vegetarian, right?
Sure, a little bit, but I think when you take a step back, it's like the same wrong.
Wrong, like, but wrong.
Yeah.
Wrong, you're saying. Remember Happy Days when Fonzie was wrong? He couldn't say wrong.
I don't.
He'd be like, I was... Like he couldn't bring himself to say it. That was funny shit.
I know people. I know people though who will shoot a deer purposefully to donate it, and they view that as like a way to give back. So they are.
But do they also shoot a few for their own freezer?
Yeah.
But why not just give money to the food bank?
It's a different way to go about it. And maybe I don't know. Maybe part of it is because they enjoy the hunting aspect of it. So to your point, there's food, there's fun, and then also there's the management perspective too. They might need to be taking some management deer off the farm or something like that. So that might be part of it. But
I'm just devil's advocate, man.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing is though, if this guy is fundamentally opposed to the eating of meat, so what if his so many people I imagine. Would advocate for the vegetarian or vegan lifestyle because they don't want an animal's life to be take or blood on their hands, maybe, or something like that. So this guy obviously doesn't care about that.
He's not that kind.
He's not that guy. So then what's his angle?
I don't know. It's just weird. Just
plant-based diet. Health.
So it's a health maybe. Thing for him.
I do now and then again, man, just like playing devil's advocate because I can see both sides of it to a crippling degree. But I do now and then wonder if you don't want like, let's say you're in a situation where, you don't want it. Why not just let someone who wants it get it? Why not, like, leave it for someone that wants it?
I get that. I have a hard time. I can't justify killing an animal unless I'm actually going to personally eat it. So I would have a hard time doing that. But I also can understand people that do. I mean, there's something to be said about helping other people with food. It's a food acquisition process. I know a lot of guys that maybe will keep a little bit and then share the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I share a significant portion of venison sometimes too. Like I'll have a surplus and I'll share that. And I guess like there's some, where's the line where that becomes questionable? I don't know.
That's why I'm thinking about this because I'm kind of like the worst kind of person. Where I'll share it with people who are I'll share it with people who are relative to the population in general quite wealthy, and I think that that's just great,
right?
But then when someone shoots a deer and just brings it down to a food bank, I'm like, hey, what's that all about? But I'm like, well, hold on, I'm giving it to like I give game meat to rich people,
right?
That's the anti Robin
like,
Hood, man.
It's like. Why not go, like, you know, wouldn't it be a lot better to go give it to the needy?
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to pick up the processing fee.
Yeah.
What if someone was, like, one of your buddies was like, man, it's the last week elk season. I'm not going to be able to get out. You have a few free days. You think you could, and you had a cow tag or something.
My own cow tag.
Your own cow tag. And your freezer was full. You didn't plan on filling that cow tag because your freezer is full and... If you were to shoot another one, you would have way too much for the year.
Is it a good friend?
It could be whoever. But yeah, someone's like
for a good.
Someone's
friend.
Like Steve. I'm not going to get out anymore.
Yes,
you think you could
for a good friend?
You could burn that cow tag for me.
Yeah, for a good friend, I would do that.
Okay,
but you're right, and I'm just the kind of worst kind of person where I wouldn't be like, you know what, I'm going to do it and pay the processing and drop it off at the food bank. So, because I'm suspicious of that for a weird reason that doesn't make any sense. And it's making me feel a little embarrassed that I feel this way.
Well, it's because the food bank's like the easy way out. Like, I know people that would shoot shit and just take it to the food bank because they don't want to deal with it.
That's okay. Yeah, you're helping me articulate my perspective on it because, like, I bring a lot. You have a lot of assumptions. So in some way you're kind of looking at it like, you're sort of reading into their motivations. Because let's say you met a guy who's a volunteer at the food bank, and he's like, "Man, I've volunteered for 10 years at the food bank, and I'm telling you, it's really hard. Like the protein is hard to come by, and when we get the venison in, people love it, and it like makes their day, and it's such a nice thing we're able to do at the food bank. And once I had that experience, I really started just like, you know, I'd get a deer for me, but I really would just keep hunting because I love to support my local food bank. That dude, I'd want to give him a big old hug.
Yeah.
But if it's the kind of thing, I one time, let me give you, the first time I ever hunted in Texas, I was hunting with a guy. And it was like a, my old girlfriend's dad had a dentist buddy or something like that. And he caught wind of the fact I like to go hunt, and he took me out hunting down by Waco, Texas. And I got a buck. And he comes and comes around to pick me up where I was hunting at my blind, and comes around and sees the deer and just says, ah, maybe I can get JJ to take this. That perspective, where he was like inconvenienced by the idea of having to deal with a deer and its meat,
yeah,
is something that I like. I see that, and I think about that being like a little bit offensive to me.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. So I have guests come and hunt, and they know that I donate the meat to my inner city employees.
I like that though.
But they have no intention of taking it. They know I have an outlet for it. Does that, it's still.
Why do they want to kill it? Do they really care about your employees that much? If so.
No, that's my question is I don't feel great about it. I have an outlet. They know that I have people that are in need and very much want the protein, and that the deer will not be wasted. I think a lot of it's the, you know, the deer camp experience and sitting around and,
yeah,
and eating and drinking. But then they know that there's an outlet for the protein. It obviously benefits someone. They know it. But I feel a little bit uncomfortable when they feel good about themselves, that, you know, they're hunting and they feel that there's some altruistic outlet for it. That's just not the way hunting should be. It should be, you know, obviously that they have every intention of consuming the animal themselves. So I feel like I set up an environment sometimes that I'm a little conflicted.
But you know what? When I'm up at my fish shack in Alaska and we're stacking up salmon and halibut, I already know that I'm going to give a bunch of it to my neighbors, who are hardly needy. Not even kind of sort of needy.
So if I came to your fish shack with the intention of fishing, knowing that I'm not taking it, that you're going to give it to your neighbors that are not needy, does that change it?
Okay, here's where we're getting into the nitty gritty. This is interesting. Let's say you're at my fish shack and you said to me, you know what, dude, funny thing, all week we've been stacking up salmon and halibut. I don't eat fish. I'm going to give this all to my neighbors. I would say you can't take any home with you. If you said, dude, I love eating fish, definitely plan on eating fish. And you know what else I'm excited about is sharing some of my neighbors. I'd be like, all right, bro, let's load your cooler up. It's just like, it doesn't make any sense. But it's like,
I get the same conflict.
It's not binary for me. It's like it's just different, man. It's like, because I need to know I need to be comfortable with the motivation, and I need to be like when you see the fish come up out of the depths, like when you see the halibut come up out of the depths, like I need to know what you're looking at. I need to know like what you see. Of course, it's a fish, but what do you see of the fish? And that's important to me. And so you're looking for like clues. It's like, what does this person see when he sees a fish?
It feels a little bit, you know, I've had people that I've not asked back because it felt a little bit more like they were into killing and I'm the outlet for the protein, you know, so I didn't feel like they were truly bought into the hunting experience. Although they know there's, a charitable element to it, I just don't feel like they have skin in the game.
You know what you could do if you were a real prick? If you got a guy like this, take him, he gets an elk or gets a deer, you'd be like, you know what, man, I don't feel like messing with this. Let's just take the head and split. And if he says, yeah, you're right, then you know not to invite him back.
You escort him immediately to the edge of the property.
It's a good litmus test.
I got a buddy who might be throw an even different direction into it. or different layer rather. He loves to hunt, hates killing, eats meat, but doesn't really, like, he'd be fine with donating. Like, he's the type of dude who would, if he was on a deer hunt and everybody's like, we're going to donate all these deer, he would love it because he would get the aspect of hunting. He'd feel better about the killing and he wouldn't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, he like hates killing shit, but he also like doesn't really want to deal with.
So what is it? He needs to find something new to do.
I know, it's so weird. He loves duck hunting because he likes the like anonymity of when you're hunting with like a bunch of dudes and a bunch of ducks come in. Cause you're like, everybody's shooting. You're like, I don't really know who shot what. I kind of, what I mean? But he also loves, he likes the idea and goes deer and turkey hunting.
My father described that about being in World War II, where he said he was in a situation once where he like very definitely needed to kill some, like he killed someone where it was like very obvious that he killed a person. And that weighed on him. But all the time you spend where everybody's just shooting and all this stuff, you never need to.
Yeah.
He talked about that. He says, you don't know. And then it came a point where he killed a person with a hand grenade.
Whoa.
And was certain that it happened. And he says, and that's the thing I think about. Not just like mortaring someplace and everyone shooting and just mayhem and, you know, but the minute you go like, oh man, that was my action.
Yeah.
That's the one that stuck with him.
That's heavy.
And if I remember it right too, he was telling me that he thought the person was drunk. But then another relative of mine heard the story and he didn't hear that part. He thought they were drunk. A person was drunk and maybe lost.
Weird, man.
Mm-hmm. At night in the dark. Yeah. He never forgave the Germans. Have I talked about this?
Yeah. Yes, you did.
Yeah. Never forgave them.
It's tough, man. It's a tough
one. Did you work up a good pitch for that book?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think that the Meat Eater book needs to be tied in with a guy's ability to get women.
Okay.
I like it. I think it.
And you went to business school, right?
It can expose him to his lady friend that he's sensitive, that he knows how to, it can open up the idea that he gets to hunt more as long as he brings, a good meal and a bottle of wine to the dinner table. I think you could do some type of promotion where if a guy does meet a woman, he has to buy 5 more cookbooks. So, I would definitely take this on as my number one product.
I like it. What was your backup sales pitch?
My backup sales pitch would be get the women to buy it for their man. Okay. It's not gonna lead. It makes the woman appear to be sensitive and cares about her man and what he likes to do on the side. And it's something that they could do together. I think that a gal and a guy could definitely, create a new life together with a Meat Eater cookbook.
So really good, man.
I think we've got a kind of a matchmaker going male, female, female, male.
Great job, Matt.
I like that.
Great job.
I think he's right. I don't think you're bullshitting us.
Oh, no, there's no question. I actually intend to do it. I've been married 26 years, so I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah.
I want a little bit about the book for real. Not even, of course, it's for real, but I really do need people to go buy the book. And you're not going to like it's a beautiful book, right, Giannis?
Yes, gorgeous.
How long have we been working on this book?
When did we go to Wyoming and trap those beavers? Oh, that was like 2016.
No, we were working on it before then.
Not much.
Not much before
that was then. That was spring of 2016. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I cannot imagine how much work this was.
2.5 years.
Because that was the first thing we started to try to collect because we realized it would be hard and we were uniquely suited to make the book because we wanted to start collecting processing photos.
Mm-hmm.
Collect processing photos of things that people wouldn't weren't going to be likely to be able to go and get all of a sudden. So we have processing photos in the book of like how to process, how to cut up and process things ranging from wild pig, white-tailed deer, mahi-mahi, crabs,
turtle, beaver. We had pictures of the beaver, but it didn't make it.
No, but the beaver tail recipe is in there.
Yeah.
Frogs.
How to process for, I mean, I'm not even kind of like scratching the surface. Yeah, how to process, clean and process bullfrogs. How to clean and process squirrels. How to clean and process rabbits. 1,000 ways to cut game birds, meaning how to spatchcock birds, how to cut them in half, breast them, plucking them, skinless, boneless, breasts. All of this information is in the book. Hand that book over here, Matt. You're just admiring the beautiful pictures.
Oh, man, I love it.
That's definitely what everybody does the first time they open it and skim through it. Everybody just sort of looks at the pictures and skims over the words.
So we start with collecting all these processing photos. And in the meantime, like Dirt Myth has tons of photographs in here because he took a lot of what we, in the working on it, we would call them the lifestylers. So there's a lot of like lifestyler pictures in here. Another section that we put in here, in everything. So like earlier when I mentioned how it's laid out, where it's laid out into these chapters where it goes big game, small game, waterfowl, upland birds, freshwater fish, saltwater fish, reptiles and amphibians, shellfish and crustaceans. And then there's like an extra thing called basic and not so basic sauces, sides, and accompaniments. And each chapter is broken out with like an introduction of what's going on and kind of gives like general thoughts about the thing, all kinds of beautiful pictures. And then we have this section that we worked on a fair bit called The Nature of the Beast. And what I try to capture in the book and explain to people is that I don't generally think that, well, let me put it this way. Sometimes like you'll go online, we'll put up a thing where it's like a recipe for an elk heart. And someone will say, oh, do you have a recipe for a moose heart? And kind of an operating thesis in this wild game book is that the species of the animal that we're talking about when it comes to, say, horned and antlered game, that the species of the animal does not matter as much as the cut. Did we talk about this on a recent podcast episode, Yanni?
I don't know about recent. I'm sure that we've covered it at some point, but...
Meaning a shank recipe, when it comes to horned and antlered game, say... And in the case of shanks, also black bears and wild pigs, that a shank recipe is a shank recipe. It doesn't matter if you have a shank from an antelope, a mule deer, a whitetail. It just doesn't matter. It's like cooking shank is cooking shank. So I try to get away from these like cookbooks, these wild game cookbooks, and I own many, that break it out. We're like, here's the antelope recipes. Here's the whitetail recipes. Here's the mule deer or elk recipes. Because it's just like, this is a much better way to approach wild game. However, there are like exceptions. And so each chapter has this section called The Nature of the Beast, where it's kind of like tasting notes on all the different varieties, sort of like general best practices and guidelines. So for the big game Nature of the Beast, it's sort of like a general breakdown, like what are American pronghorn or antelope like what are they known for? What are some of the things you can expect from the meat on them? Same with black bear, caribou, elk, moose, mule deer, white-tailed deer, wild pigs. Like generally, what are best practices for handling them? And what are the exceptions? And what it's meant to be is it's meant to serve as a thing to help guide you through substitutions. If you live in the eastern U.S. and you only hunt whitetails, you might be like, well, that doesn't do me any good because I'm just dealing with whitetails anyways. But keep in mind that we do the same thing. The same Nature of the Beast thing for freshwater fish, where we talk about all of your varieties of freshwater fish, your panfish, the different bass species, northerns, pickerel, smelt, salmon, trout, you name it. All of the guidelines on like best practices for handling the fish and how to figure out substitutions. So when you're on something and you're looking, this guy's got like, oh, here's a great walleye recipe. It's like, well, I don't fish walleye. How do you make sense of the fish that you do have in order to be able to use them in generally cooking and using substitutions? Because I think that in wild game cooking, it's like really important to get away from this idea that there is such a thing as a walleye recipe. There's really not. I would say there's a recipe for mild, white, flaky, freshwater fish for sure. And so how to like help you make sense of that. Gambrel skinning. So how to skin an animal on a gambrel. How to do it underground. So like a detailed piece about how to go ahead and like break down big giant animals laying on the ground. And then we put all these other kind of like little micro sections in here where we have a thing about the big buck myth. So there's a lot of like, even wild game cooks always push this idea that it's like young animals are really good to eat and big bucks are no good to eat. So we kind of like put that to test and talk a little bit about that. We have sections on evidence of sex requirements, sections on what want and waste means, section on chronic waste and disease, how to completely bone out, how to tabletop bone out a whitetail deer and what cuts you want to wind up with. So when you're working on your whitetail deer and you want to plan out where you have a variety of meals you can eat throughout the year, how to like cut your whitetail deer up, what you should do, like different ways of approaching the front legs, boning them out for burger, using them, cutting it for ossobuco, cutting it for blade roasts, on and on. Jump in here, Jan, if you need to. Ribs, whole ribs, not whole ribs.
Boning out the leg. I was going to say that, and I'm sure most cookbooks do this, most authors of cookbooks do this, but I was impressed with how
Krista Ruane.
Who put more
oomph into this book than anybody else.
Yes. Yeah, we definitely owe her a lot of credit. But she made sure that every recipe in there was like not only checked and vetted, but probably 3, 4, sometimes 6 times over by professional chefs, and sometimes by 2 and 3 professional chefs. And then
she would
say, you know what, Yanni, I'm not quite 100% on, you know, that tea smoked duck breast recipe, which so far is like one of my favorites. It was a real eye opener for me. Because I got to try it because she asked me to try it to make sure the timing was right to get it to the temp. And if you've never tried it, it's smoked, but it's something you just do at home with, like, you basically like make your own mini smoker by just lining a pan with aluminum foil and putting a lid on it. Sweet recipe. And I tried it and I was like, yeah, it was spot on, you know, whatever it was, 8 or 10 minutes of smoking, and it was spot on. So, I was just impressed on how much emphasis she put into that, to really vetting the recipes and making sure that they were just like super dialed in.
Yeah, we knew. I've known Krista Ruane for years because the production company, 0.0 Production, has always produced Meat Eater, the TV show. They Yanni's the producer of the show. We work on it. I work on writing, hosting, conceptualizing, Yanni conceptualizing and producing, but the company that's done under and handles all the post-production things is 0.0 Production. And Krista does other stuff with them because they do a lot of food content. And Krista oversaw the creation of the book and took a lot of, like, you know, she's worked for quite a number of famous, you know, celebrity chefs and other, you know, high-end restaurant chefs, and took a lot of those best practices to make sure. And so we ran it through where she has a team of recipe testers that we would run all the stuff through. And she was also really good about making sure that in going through it, that we had recipes that accounted for everything. So we have like how to make scotch eggs from the big game section, how to make scotch eggs, different ways of handling liver, ways to handle marrow bones, ways to handle raw venison, tongue. And then like general things like how to roast a hunk of meat to perfection is one of the recipes in here, where it's like, rather than just giving a recipe, it's like how to do a technique for how to make perfect roasts all the time. And then loin, then we make sure to have like particular things. So like wild hog dishes, and then a bunch of bulk wild game sausages, and a pictorial explanation of how to stuff and make your own sausages. How to do burger, like general best practices on how to handle big game burger when it comes to cutting with fat or not, and how to go about doing all that by yourself. All kinds of preparations for ground meat, ways of making pick meat for tacos, how to handle bone-in ribs off antlered big game, more recipes on how to cook shanks and ossobuco, how to can meat. Yanni, you did that one.
I did.
Bunch of jerky stuff.
Bunch of jerky stuff. I came out of that no feeling like that raw packed is the way to go.
Yeah.
Raw packed canned meat.
When I was a little boy, when you canned meat, you always browned it first.
It just seems like the logical thing to do.
Yeah.
Putting a bunch of raw meat into a glass jar and then sticking it into a pressure cooker doesn't seem like the logical thing to do, but when you do both of them side by side, you end up with a better product by doing it that way.
The thing that you found when you were working on it that I thought was interesting is when you brown it, it firms.
Yeah.
It firms up, and so it doesn't pack as tight.
Right.
But my mom canned a lot of venison, man. And yeah, you brown in the cubes and they firm up, and then you wind up with a lot of airspace, and you got to top it with liquid. But when you wet pack, it's just meat.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you're like, by doing the browning, a lot of that flavor was being left in the pan, and the juices were being left in the pan, and maybe evaporating. Where when you just put the raw into the can, it can't go anywhere.
It catches it all.
It's all in there.
We had, when I was a kid, my mom had a canning room. It was like the laundry room, but the hallway that led to the laundry room was called the canning room. And my dad had built wooden shelves, and it was lined with canned venison and all the stuff that came out of our garden. And my mom would go to the farmer's market and can all that. And it was like you're walking down a corridor of canning jars. That was old day stuff, man. I used to think it was cool. Another thing that people like about the book is if you watch Meat Eater, the TV show, there's certain recipes that really hit us hard. Like, for instance, we did a hog trapping episode down in Texas. And in the end of the show, we took our pigs to a guy that processes wild hogs. Clayton Saunders was his name in Divine, Texas. And he made the best wild pig shoulder I've ever had in my life. And had like that special sop
mm-hmm.
that he learned from someone. Was it his daddy taught him how to make the sop or some crazy thing like that?
I can't remember. But I use it all the time. That sop is good stuff. And then when you're done sopping with it, you just add a little more ketchup and reduce it a little bit, and it makes the finest barbecue sauce.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So there are certain recipes in here that you might know from the show that we went and dialed in and tested and make sure they got it right, and those recipes are in here. Like, that's called the South Texas Wild Hog Shoulder. And then there's how to smoke. Finally, like, and this is one of the ones that took a lot of testing to get it where it would work for anyone, is how to take a whole deer leg. So you kill a whitetail, take its back leg, how to brine and smoke a whole deer leg. And I think that we eventually hit on probably a pretty fail-safe way of doing it. The key being you need to brine it way longer than you think you do. But it was one we did and did and did and finally got where I am like very confident that any Joe Schmo.
Well, yeah,
even Ridge Pounder.
Yeah, you're
not even candle.
You're not going to get a gray deer leg. But when we did it with that sick deer recently, it came out perfect.
I think it's dialed now. So now here, like, take for instance here. You know, I wish I had one of those numbers. Call now. Anywhere books are sold. You can go on Amazon right now and pre-order.
Press pause right now and go on Amazon.
And then you can just go, once you get it done, just go about your day. Turn off the, go listen to something else. But I'm just going to, but bear with me. So I open up the small game section, and we have our nature of the beast stuff. So we talk all about the different kinds of squirrels, gray squirrels, fox squirrels, pine squirrels, right? Black phase, gray phase, explain all that. Get into rabbits. We talk about eastern cottontails, swamp rabbits, mountain cottontails, snowshoe hares, jackrabbits. What's all up with those? Then the aquatic rodent section. So like tasting notes on muskrats, beavers, tasting notes on the rogue outliers like raccoon, porcupine, possum. And then get into different ways of skinning. So like pants and legs or shirts and pants method of skinning for cottontails. Yanni has a beautiful demonstration of how to tail skin. Turned out really nice. Tail skin and squirrels.
Yeah, gray squirrel.
Done very well. You can get a good look at the Latvian power ring in this section. How to part.
Doug Dern and I went out and shot that squirrel together.
Mm-hmm. How to how to part out, like best practices on parting out rabbits and squirrels into serving size portions, and then how to make buffalo wild wings or buffalo hot wings, which are called, we call them here, buffalo hot legs. How to take squirrel and rabbit and make a thinking man's wild wing, hot wing. What do you call them? People
hot
call
wings.
Them different.
Hot wings.
Hot wings.
It's a great photograph for that one, too.
Oh, dude, yeah.
On the tray.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite.
The old school lunch tray.
Yeah, the lunch tray.
You got your blue cheese. You got your celery sticks, your carrot sticks. You got a can of soda pop and a big plate of squirrel hot legs, buffalo hot legs.
I think it's a can of beer.
Oh, it's beer?
Yeah. Probably like a single hop IPA, I'm thinking.
Yeah, so how to make...
Inside joke, Matt, inside joke.
Hopefully, how to make buffalo wings with squirrel and rabbit. It is like I think that is a great... Have you had it, Mark?
I have not. I'm intrigued.
Can I make you some this week?
I would love it.
We already got three squirrels.
I know it.
I will make you some of that.
Sounds really good.
Here's one that not a lot that you might like the pictures for, even though a lot of guys aren't likely to make it, is how to fire roast a beaver tail and kind of the story of how that came to be a thing from the mountain man era. How to roast beaver tail and get the fat out of it. There's another thing. Like if you watch the Meat Eater TV show and we go down and do a small game episode with Kevin Murphy, we have Kevin Murphy's recipe in Kevin Murphy's word, Kentucky style squirrel gravy with cat head biscuits straight from Kevin Murphy. All about how to make cat head biscuits. Then you go into rabbit curry, gumbo, barbecue smoked beaver sandwiches, rabbit or squirrel and creamy mustard sauce, cacciatore. Then we go into waterfowl, and we get the same thing. We got the tasting notes and then the different processing things. So all explaining all about like dabbling ducks, how to handle and think about teal, wood ducks, mallards, pintails, black ducks, widgeon, gadwalls, shovelers. How to think about your divers, where you got your kind of high-end divers like canvasbacks, redheads, ringneck ducks, and scaup, scoters. Then you got your lower-end divers like buffleheads and goldeneyes. Then you got your low-end mergansers. Like, what can you do with these things? How best to handle them to wind up with passable stuff? Then all kinds of thoughts on geese, Canada geese, white fronts, snows, cranes. Like what these different things mean. A big breakdown on all how to use all manner of guts from everything you hunt, with a big section on bird giblets. So how to do gizzards, hearts, livers from all your waterfowl and upland game birds, how to clean your gizzards out, how to de-tendon. Like if you're ever eating a duck and you wind up with how the back legs has so many tendons, it almost makes it like not worthwhile. Oh, there's Latvian power ring there. Yanni demonstrated that. How to cut a duck's leg and pull the foot so that you pull all the tendons out of the back leg and you wind up with a much better product. How to burn off pin hairs with a blowtorch when you're doing it. My special way of cutting mallard ducks, we wind up with a boneless breast and bone-in leg, bone-in thigh and drumstick, which is a genius way of doing it. Handling geese. How to make a waterfowl liver pate. Skewered and grilled duck hearts, which can be substituted with turkey hearts, goose hearts, and explanations of all that kind of stuff. Duck nachos, wild goose pastrami, soy sauce duck, ginger scallion oil, tea smoked duck, braised waterfowl, seared goose, how to make duck raviolis. Should I go on?
Well, you're just making me really hungry.
It is dinner time.
We haven't eaten dinner yet, and this is really getting my tummy rumbling.
Yeah. That's all. Like I said, I told you up front, it was the worst episode of the podcast ever, but it's one I just had to do because I just want people to know about the fact that we put a lot of work and a lot of time and tons of people worked on it. And it's like the magnum opus, man. It's like the great compendium of wild game cooking.
Ultimate stocking stuffer.
Big stocking.
Combined with Barry White and a bottle of wine, it'd be good. I'm telling you, you'll sell like hotcakes.
Yeah, and I was just doing that really annoying run through of what's in there, but I didn't even begin to scratch the surface. Because we hadn't gotten into all the fishing parts and hadn't gotten into a lot of the hunting parts.
Do you envision that maybe 100 years from now, someone might come upon this old cookbook and look at it and be inspired to go out and try to find all the ingredients necessary to recreate these recipes? It'd be such
and
a great
write
story.
A book called Scavenger's Guide.
Yeah. Could that possibly happen?
Dude, that would be like if in 100 years someone wanted to make a movie, it'd be a great movie.
It would.
Yeah, that someone would do with that what I did with the Escoffier.
Uh-huh.
You really need to buy 3 copies. One is the present, and then you really need to have 2 for yourself because it is coffee table worthy. You've
absolutely.
All flipped through it. You
oh,
guys
dude,
agree?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, man.
It's totally worthy of just having a clean coffee table copy to flip through as you're having some coffee.
And then
or
have
beer.
Your dirty copy.
And then,
got,
yeah,
like,
the one that's going to go right next to the Joy of Cooking yeah. in the pantry, get mm-hmm. all scuffed up, dirty.
Yeah.
Covered in blood and grease.
It's a big hardcover book with a dust jacket, and on the front is a really beautiful picture of game ribs and a moose antler. That's all, man. It's like a lot of times at the end of these shows, I'll talk about how you could really do us a good turn or do us a real solid by going on to the Apple store and clicking the rightmost star to give us a 5-star rating. I'll talk about that kind of stuff. Or to go to themeateater.com and get our newsletter, which is very helpful to me if people go and do that. But this is the greatest favor I could ever ask of listeners of the show is you go and order the cookbook now. That's all, man. You got any concluding thoughts, Giannis? Do you think we're screwing people by having an episode like this?
No, not at all. Because I've been paying attention to the old time, the clock here, and I feel like they got a very entertaining 40 minutes before you ever even jumped into selling the cookbook.
So we did them right.
Oh, yeah.
In 140-some episodes, there's one episode that's all about people just needing to do me a huge favor. So if you do one in 140, that's not that bad.
Not that bad at all. No. If you're going to complain about this one, then you're like the worst kind of freeloader out there.
That's right.
I do have it's kind of a concluding thought, but I really want to tell you, lest people think that I'm just really not doing my job. I want to tell you about why rabbits eat their own feces.
Oh, yeah.
This is written recently by an intern at the McGill Office for Science and Society. Rabbits are foraging herbivores, eating mostly grass and weeds. But this fibrous, cellulose-rich diet isn't the easiest to digest, and by the time dinner has made it through their intestines, it still contains many of the nutrients rabbits need. Rabbits and hares beat this problem with a special kind of digestion called hindgut fermentation. In short, they eat their own poop and digest it a second time. They actually make 2 different kinds of droppings, little black round ones, which is probably the ones we're most often seeing, and then a softer black one known as cecotropes that are eaten. And this process is known as, you said it earlier.
Say it again.
I don't know if I'm going to
pronounce it. Something phagy.
Yeah. Coprophagy.
Coprophagy.
And functions the same as cows or elk, deer chewing their cud. So, and it's not only is it important because they're getting that kind of second harvest, if you remember that joke, but it keeps their digestive system flowing smoothly, so they have to do it.
I used to know a good joke about a man who was made to eat another man's feces. Mm. And I always liked the punchline. The punchline was, I had lunch with him 2 weeks ago Monday. Mark, you got any concluding thoughts?
Buy the book. And, you know, not to ask too much, but if you like it, I imagine you'd appreciate a review on Amazon.
Yep. Yeah, that, or buy 2.
Or buy 2.
Mark Kenny from Wired to Hunt, thanks for joining us. You didn't get to lay a whole lot of whitetail wisdom on us.
No, hopefully we'll have another chance to do that soon.
I'm hoping we have another chance. So yep. We have some whitetail adventures today.
And we'll have more tomorrow and the next day. And
Yanni hopefully. Had what he called his number one best day of deer hunting ever today.
We should tease that. Listen to a future episode to find out what happened.
Ridge Pounder.
Buy the book, man.
That's it?
Just buy it. Buy a couple copies.
Do you think they should do it just because I'm begging? Is it that?
No, they should do it because if they actually are like into any of this stuff, it'll be a game changer. 100%.
Yeah.
I do think it would be different if you spent a whole podcast talking about why they should buy the book, but the book was actually lousy. then you could all right, this is rough. But the fact that you're doing them a favor by telling them about the best wild game cookbook out there.
You know what I'm going to do? It's too late for anyone to be helpful, but I'm going to call this episode Begging and Pleading so that people don't get the wrong impression about what the episode is.
Yeah.
But then they won't. No, it'll be helpful still.
Or you could call it Doing You a Favor.
No, I think I'm going to call it. Yeah, you know what? I like that better. I'm going to call it Doing You a Favor.
There you go.
It's a good idea, Mark. I was going to call it Begging and Pleading, which is so pathetic.
Yeah, you got to come from a position of strength, Steve.
Seth Morris.
Thanksgiving's coming.
Oh, yeah. Hadn't talked about Thanksgiving.
There's a shitload of recipes in there that would be fitting.
Oh, dude. Do you mind?
Take it away.
Okay. My brother knows a chef. And the chef, it's a long story. My brother hangs out with a chef who doesn't hunt. But my brother would present him with wild turkeys. And the chef, over time, to my brother's estimation, perfected the art of making a Thanksgiving turkey with a wild turkey, which is no mean task, no small task.
Yeah, no, that's not easy.
He perfected it where my brother says it is not just the best wild turkey, but the best turkey that exists is cooked by this man named Shannon. And he allowed us to use his recipe. So this is the first time it's ever been printed.
Wow.
And worked with us to go through the process. And then we beautifully photographed this thing. But this man's creation of the perfect whole roasted wild turkey.
It's in there.
In there.
That's one reason alone just to buy the damn thing.
So go on, Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving's coming. Christmas is coming.
Valentine's. Memorial Day. There you go. You know, Memorial Day.
And if you don't even like to cook at all, but you like appreciate really fine photography, just buy the damn book.
Or if you shoot deer and bring them to a food bank, you should bring that book down to the food bank too and drop it off.
It's okay. Yeah. Donate the book.
Buy the book and donate it to the food bank.
Matt, concluding thought?
Yeah. First of all, I don't think this podcast has been a commercial. I think it's reinforcing people's passion for everything that you guys are about.
God, this guy's good.
Mm-hmm. Reinforcing your passion.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you for bearing with me as I present to you the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook, recipes and techniques for every hunter and angler. Buy one now, or hell, buy two. And have a good night.